Pennsylvania. GE says that should bring up to 150 more jobs to the area by early 2013.
What you gonna call him?
I think I'll call him Bambi.
Bambi. Yep, I guess I'll do all right.
Bambi is among the 25 films chosen to be included and preserved this year in the National Film Registry at the Library of Congress. The oldest reels in this year's collection date from 1912, two silent movies, The Cry of the Children and A Cure for Pokeritis. A Charlie Chaplin film is on the list, as is the hit starring Tom Hanks, Forrest Gump. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Intuit. With Intuit Payroll, small businesses can pay employees, file tax forms, and manage payroll. Learn more at payroll.com.
On December 31st, WILL will be halfway through the fundraising year. Our goal during the month of December is to raise $500,000. If we work together, we can reach that goal. Every gift can make a difference, and your contribution to WILL is tax-deductible if you contribute by December 31st. Please support the programs you enjoy. Give online at willpledge.org. And thanks.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of Focus, we'll be talking with neuroscientist David Eagleman. He is a researcher who works at the Baylor College of Medicine, and he is a scientist who is interested in the brain and how it functions and how this piece of tissue, this lump of stuff that we carry around in our skulls, influences our behavior. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas and thoughts and bits of research you will find in a new book that he's authored. The title is Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. It's published by Pantheon. And in the book, he makes this argument that our brains are in the business of gathering information and steering behavior, and they're doing this all day long. But it is not something, mostly, it is not something that we are aware of. Most of the time, he says, our brains run on autopilot. Most of what we do and think is not under our conscious control. So we'll talk a little bit about the depths of the unconscious brain and perhaps find out why it is, in some cases at least, actually a good thing that much of our mental life is not under our conscious control. If you'd like to take a look at the book, it is out now. Our guest, David Eagleman, directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor, also the Initiative on Neuroscience and the Law. And he's written professional journals, but he's also authored a number of books that are aimed at a general audience, as is Incognito. He's interested in a number of particular things in his laboratory. He does work on time perception, and he is also interested in how neuroscience affects the way that we think about the law, which has some very important implications for how it is we think about people who break the law. And Professor Eagleman, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And how are you?
Very well, thank you.
This is a really fascinating subject. It goes in so many different directions. But I guess maybe the place to begin is this, with this idea that even the simplest things that we do require some pretty complicated, sophisticated stuff going on in our heads, in the brain, and that most of the time, it does its thing without us consciously being involved.
Well, that's exactly right. Essentially, the conscious part of your brain, the part that flickers to life when you wake up in the morning, that's the smallest bit of what's happening in your brain. That's sort of like a broom closet in the mansion of the brain, and all the rest of its massive operations are running under the hood. So we're used to thinking about things like, I don't know, your heartbeat or your breathing or your digestion as being things that operate on autopilot, and you don't have to pay any attention to them. They just run their massive programs. But it turns out that everything what you think about, what you believe in, things you're attracted to, recognizing a friend's face, falling in love, all of these things are underpinned by lightning storms of neural activity, and it's completely invisible to us.
Yeah. I think that people will appreciate why it is that certain things, breathing, for example, why it's a good thing that you don't have to think about it. Because if you did, that's all you could do all day long. You just have to be thinking about the fact that you have to breathe. Well, you're doing all these other things. I suppose the same thing applies, that if you actually had to be really conscious about what the various steps you had to go through to do even a simple action would be, you'd be paralyzed. You couldn't do anything.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think a good analogy is that the conscious mind is like the CEO of a company. So if you imagine a company with 100,000 employees in it, the CEO does not want to know all the details of what's going on in the cubicles and the mailroom and the cafeteria and so on. It's way too much information. Nothing could actually happen. In terms of a long-term vision for that company, the CEO actually wants to be shielded from those details and just know that the whole system is sort of working and can move and dynamically change to meet the goals of the company. And it's the same thing with the brain. I mean, if you imagine just picking up a cup of coffee to your mouth, there is so much activity that goes on there in your brain, but it feels invisible to us. And if it weren't for biology, you wouldn't even have reason to suspect the existence of muscles and electrical signals and tendons and nerves and so on. And it's precisely because you don't want to know that. All you want to know is the end goal, which is, did I get the coffee to my lips or did I spill it? And that's all you need to know.
Yeah. Well, that I suppose that there maybe on one hand that might be reassuring. On the other hand, people might start thinking about all of the decisions that they make in big decisions, big and small decisions that they make in their life. And it could be indeed be enormous decisions, things like who you want your life partner to be and what you want your career to be and, you know, who knows how many other things that we think we're, as much as we're swayed by emotion, we also think that we're rational and we think that we're thinking carefully about what it is we do before we do it. Well, this really argues for not having as much control as we think.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, one example that I use in the book that was very influential in my thinking about it years ago was there was a study done where men were asked to rate the attractiveness of women's faces in photographs. So they rated from 1 to 10 how attractive they thought each woman was. What the men didn't know is there were actually two sets of photographs with the same women in it, but in one set their eyes had been dilated with some eye drops. And it turns out that the men were uniformly more attracted to the women with the dilated eyes. The thing is, none of the men were able to say, oh, I noticed her pupils were a little bit larger over here than over here. Nobody picked up on that. And none of the men presumably knew that dilated eyes is a sign of sexual readiness in women. But their brains knew. Their brains picked right up on those signals and drove their behavior over to certain photographs over others. And the thing is, the conscious mind had no awareness of what was driving them there, and much in our life is exactly like this. We find ourselves attracted to certain people more than others, certain ideas more than others, certain belief systems more than others, and we almost never have access to why. But the why, especially in this case with the dilated eyes, the why is that their brains were running deep evolutionary programs. Their brains were picking up on information and analyzing it and synthesizing it and doing all the things they needed to do with it towards the end of, you know, sexual reproduction, and you don't know why you're getting these drives.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because we like to define ourselves as a species, humans. The thing that is important about us, or maybe one of the things that's important about us, is the thinking part of the brain, the front part of the brain that we have that perhaps other animals don't, or that it's more highly developed. But if you look at the brain, what you see is you can look at it in terms, think of it in terms of newer parts and older parts. And the older parts, which maybe are connected to some of the most elemental aspects of behavior, they're there. They're still there. And I'm sure that there's an interesting sort of interplay between the older parts that have something to do with very basic drives and then the newer parts that have to do with really abstract thinking and language and things like that.
Well, that's generally correct. Anything that Mother Nature discovers through evolutionary time, she conserves. And so you can find exactly the same mechanisms for chasing reward, for example, in our heads and in the brain of a little honeybee, right? It's exactly the same sorts of structures for getting nectar from flowers and figuring out which ones have the most nectar and then steering their future behavior towards doing that again. So we have these things that are conserved through evolution, and in fact, when you look at the genomes across species, you find just an incredible amount. I mean, if you compare us to a frog, we've got a lot in common with a frog, like a shocking amount in common. What humans appear to have a lot more of is what's called the neocortex. That's sort of the pink, wrinkly stuff on the outside of the brain that you see, and specifically what we have is more frontal. We have more cortex in our frontal lobes, the front half of our brain, than any of our animal cousins, and that seems to be what really allows us to think, to make executive decisions, and to abstract ourselves and think of ourselves as creatures in time with a past and a future. And I think this is what consciousness is really about, is understanding yourself as something that moves through time. And it's consciousness is essentially an abstraction of all the details going on in there, in exactly the same way that the CEO of a company is the most abstract layer of all the details and labor that the company is doing. The CEO just represents, okay, here's kind of the idea of the company. Here's sort of the long-term planning and vision of the company.
Yeah, and what even makes it more mysterious and more interesting is this sense of ourselves that we have, that we are a distinct individual. Something makes us special. There are things about other people that make them special, and we can recognize that, and we can reflect on that. That when you, as much as we know about the brain and how it works, we really have no idea how the physical structures that we can see and watch generate this thing that we call consciousness.
That's mostly right. I wouldn't say we have no idea. There's been a terrific amount of neuroscience data in the last 20 years. It still is an open question. I mean, the question of why it feels like something, that is a totally open question. I agree with you on that. As far as what brain structures are correlated with conscious states, that part we've got a lot of progress on. But the question of how do you ever build something out of physical pieces and parts and have it experience the taste of feta cheese or the redness of red or the feeling of pain, that part we don't even have any insight into yet. I mean, that's a real unsolved mystery right now.
And so if you ask this question, well, why is it that we really haven't been able to build something that would do that, a device that would do that, is that why?
Yeah, I mean, the fact is our science is still quite young. Everybody, me included, we're all singing the praises of the tremendous progress of neuroscience, but the fact is we still don't know the answer to very basic questions. How are memories stored and retrieved? What is intelligence? How do we think about emotions in this picture of an information processing system? Why do brains sleep and dream? You know, there's lots of questions that we're working on in neuroscience that sound so simple you would think they'd be solved by now, but they're not. But to me, the 800-pound gorilla in the room is the question of, what is consciousness? How do you build consciousness out of pieces and parts? In other words, why does it feel like something to exist? If I gave you a 100 billion Tinker Toys and I said, okay, I want you to hook them up in any configuration you want, put this here, this is a lever, that's a pulley, you hook them all up in this vast network, at what point do you add one more Tinker Toy and you say, ah, now it's experiencing the taste of feta cheese? That's the question that we're faced with, is the brain seems to be, in the end, just material pieces and parts. And the reason we know that is because, when the brain gets changed, so does your conscious state. People put in drugs or alcohol, that changes their conscious state. People get brain damage, that changes their state, their personality entirely. All these sorts of things. So we know that somehow the brain is tied to consciousness, but the question is, how? And the fact is, we don't have, we not only don't have a theory about that, but we don't even know what such a theory would look like, because it requires fundamentally a totally different way, a new way of thinking about it.
Our guest in this hour of focus is David Eagleman. He's a neuroscientist at the Baylor College of Medicine, where he directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action, and is also heading up the Initiative on Neuroscience and the Law. He's done a lot of scientific writing about his work, but also books for a more general audience, including his newest. And if you're interested in the kind of things we're talking about here, you might want to look at the book. It's titled Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, and it's published by Pantheon. And we have some callers here already to talk with. Let's do that, and we'll start here in Urbana, where we are. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I turned on the radio just in time to hear you talking about the pupil, eye pupil business. And I walked past news magazines with Michelle Bachmann's photo on the cover, and there's one where she looks like something out of an Exorcist movie with her eyes, and I keep being drawn to the weirdness of her eyes in other photographs, and I'm wondering whether she wears contact lenses that make her eyes look that way, or whether her, I don't have a photo in front of me, so I don't know whether it's her pupils that are enlarged or what it is, and whether she's purposely trying to take advantage of this sexual attraction that you're talking about.
Well, you know what? I don't know. I haven't looked carefully at her photographs, but the general story is that advertisers and political campaigners figure things out way before neuroscientists do, and we're always playing catch-up to figure out why these different sorts of things work. So it wouldn't surprise me in general. One of the examples I use in the book is when Bush was campaigning against Gore. Some of you may remember this. He had a commercial where you see he's talking about the Democrats, and then you see the word rats flash on the screen, and then the word sort of zooms out, and you see that it says bureaucrats. But that's a way of, you know, implanting a subliminal message that the Democrats are like rats. And, you know, it's one of the oldest tricks in the book. I mean, you know, even the Nazis were fond of doing this sort of thing in their early propaganda. And so, politicians always figure this out. And I'll just mention one other thing in the book, which is this illusion of truth effect, which has been something discovered that if you tell somebody a message enough times, even if they don't remember consciously having heard it before, if their unconscious brain has been exposed to it, they will believe it is more true. They're more likely to rate a statement as being true simply because they've heard it before. And this is really the basis of lots of campaigning ideas, not only in politics, but in religion and other cults and so on. You just keep saying something over and over, and eventually people will believe that it's true.
It's interesting because if you watch The Daily Show, and that's one of the things they point out is the reuse of a phrase over and over and over again by Fox News anchors. And you're pointing out why it works.
That's right. By the way, I would love to believe it's only Fox News that does it, but it's essentially everybody that does it.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'm sure that it has, and indeed it has to do with people of both parties, certainly, and maybe also, as you say, and if someone's trying to sell you something, you get your talking point, you get your essential idea, whatever it is you want to get across, and then you just hammer on it as much as you can.
Yep, that's right.
We have somebody in on a cell phone here, I think in Champaign, line four. Hello.
Yeah, David, thanks for taking
sure.
my call.
Yeah.
Fascinating topic. There's so many places to go with this topic. Just two quick asides. I remember a study very similar to what your guest had mentioned with men rating women, and it was very similar. These were full shots of women, and automatically the women were chosen as most attractive, had the widest, if I have this right, the widest disbursement of hips, which is conducive to childbirth. Now, the guy said no reason why they picked these women. They didn't mention their hips. They didn't mention anything. And so I just thought that was fascinating. And to take it one step further, what your guest is saying, I just wonder how much of this we're hardwired automatically to react to. And what I'm getting is you take two polar opposites, Mother Teresa and Adolf Hitler, and you could say, well, you know, their outside stimulus, the parents they had, they reacted to this in a certain way. And I'm just wondering if it's not too far afield, if your guests could talk to, well, you know, maybe they were hardwired. Adolf Hitler was hardwired to be Adolf Hitler, and Mother Teresa was hardwired to be Mother Teresa. Yes, there was outside stimulus and cultural upbringing, but I was just wondering if your guests could talk to that, if there's any volition in that, and I'll listen off air. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. Well, let me do those in reverse order. When it comes to Hitler versus Mother Teresa, what's very clear, in neuroscience, we don't even ask the nature versus nurture question anymore because the answer is always both. And there's a colleague of mine who's fond of using this expression that half of us is other people, which I really love that expression. What that means is we are so much a product of our culture, of our surrounding environment, of the people we interact with, that you can't actually think about the brain in isolation at all. So it turns out that the way a brain comes to be is a very complicated interaction of genetics and environment. So you come to the table predisposed with certain genes, but then after that, everything you experience changes your genetic expression. This includes your environment in the womb, what your mother's eating or smoking, whether there's toxic paint, you know, lead paint on the wall, toxins in the air, every experience you had, whether you were abused as a child, all of these things change the trajectory of your brain development. And so what happens is, in the end, we can never look back at, on somebody's life and say, oh, well, this much of that behavior had to do with genes and this much had to do with environment, because they intertwine with one another. And as a result, brains are like fingerprints. They are different in every person. And this is something that I'm addressing in my next several books, is this issue that, you know, the first starting point for thinking about any sorts of social problems is admitting right away that brains are really different. It's not like you can look at other people's brains and assume everybody is like you, because they're not. Okay, so that's the first one. The second one about the wider hips, it turns out it's slightly more specific than that. It's that there's a specific hip-to-waist ratio that males find most attractive on females. It happens to be representative of fertility. And it happens to go across cultures. So some cultures prefer women heavier and some skinnier, and even across time, across generations, the total body weight of models has changed. And yet what has remained constant across all of these is the hip-to-waist ratio.
Just for, I have another call, and I promise I'm going to get to this person, but I mentioned a couple of times your involvement with the initiative on neuroscience and the law, and going to this question of, well, what is it that makes a person the person that he or she is, and then how does that hook up with their behavior? If indeed so much of our behavior is beyond our control, and you, in the book, for example, you cite this really interesting example. Some people will indeed remember this, of the case of the man Charles Whitman. This was in 1966, who went up to the top of the Texas Tower in Austin with a gun and shot a bunch of people. Afterwards, on autopsy, it was determined that this man had a brain tumor that certainly had changed his behavior. He thought so. Now, maybe not in every case can you do an autopsy and you can look in there and find something and point to it and say, aha, you see here, right, this is it. But if there's so much that's beyond our behavior, then that, you know, that leads you to think very differently about what you should do with someone who's broken the law.
Exactly right. And it turns out that we still have to take bad actors off the street. So there's nothing about understanding the biology of behavior that sort of lets people off the hook. It is the case, in one way of looking at it, that it's not their fault. I mean, certainly Charles Whitman didn't choose to have a brain tumor. And yet, there's nothing we can do about that. We still have to deal with people appropriately and take them off the street. What a biological understanding of behavior gives us is a legal system where we can have customized sentencing, where we don't have to treat everybody exactly the same and throw everybody in jail for the same length of term. We can introduce new customized methods for rehabilitation. We can try to help people where possible. It's not always possible, but where possible, we can try to help people to get them back into society in some way. Because as it stands now, prison is criminogenic, meaning it causes more crime. When we put people in American prisons, we break their social circles and their employment opportunities, and they're very likely to come circling back around. Now, some of your listeners may know this, but not everybody, and that is that America is number one in the world for the percentage of our population behind bars. Mm-hmm. We have more of our people behind bars than any place in the world. That's not the right thing to be doing, either from a humane perspective or from a cost-efficacy perspective. It turns out that a third of our prison population has mental illness. Our prison system has become our de facto mental health care system. And, of course, our prisons are also stuffed with people who have drug addiction problems, which, again, is not the most fruitful thing to be doing with somebody with a drug addiction. It doesn't help them. It just, again, causes more crime because that's their new social circles that they learn from. So if we actually want to have any efficacy in any of this, we need to have a more refined system where we make mental health courts, we make drug courts, we have rehabilitation strategies. And this is where I think neuroscience will really be able to update the legal system.
Okay. Well, let's go to another caller here in Champaign County, here where we are, line two. Yes.
Hi. I thought this was going to be more about brain structure and stuff like that. So if that's not right, then these questions won't be germane, but you were talking earlier about the old brain and the new brain. I wonder if this piece of research stood up to testing. I remember reading about something where a person had a damaged optic nerve, but they were still able to answer questions about, you know, they were nominally blind, but they were still able to accurately answer questions about broad things in the environment or something. And the theory was that there was some deeper neural connection that they were responding to. I'm not very clear on this because it's been a while since I read it. And the other thing is this broad stroke sort of idea of the bicamerality of the brain. And I'm wondering how much that's treated in your discussions in the book. And
You'll be happy to know that both of those issues are dealt with in Incognito.
Okay. Well, there's one other thing, and that's just more generally, if I could. How far along are there individual structures in the brain being associated with particular things? You hear about the hypothalamus a lot, but are there more fine structures in the brain that are being located in the sense of their growth structure? We've always had this idea of it's a hologram and it has to work all together, but there are contrary kind of arguments as well. And I guess I'll hang up and listen on the air.
Okay.
Okay, well, thanks for those questions. Let me answer a few things. What the caller described at first is called blind sight, which is where somebody can be blind and say, look, doc, I can't see in this half of my visual field. But if the doctor says, look, I want you to guess, am I holding up a circle, a square, or a triangle here? The person says, look, I don't know, I'm blind there. And the doctor says, just take a guess. What's your hunch? They can actually guess above chance. It's called blind sight. And what it means is that there are parts of the brain that are still having vision, even though you're not having conscious visual experience. Now, just a small correction, it's not damage to the optic nerve, because if the optic nerve is damaged, then no visual information is coming in at all. Instead, it's damage to the primary visual cortex. In other words, the part of the brain that's doing some of the analysis on the vision. It turns out there are other back roads that the brain can use in order to do that analysis. So that's called blind sight, and that's dealt with in the book. Coming back to the main question at the end about individual structures in the brain, it turns out that, you know, the brain really is this massive network, and we as humans are always attracted to breaking things up into parts and paying attention to individual structures. But it's probably, in the end, not the right way to look at the brain. Just like if you were looking at the economy of the nation, if you treated farmers completely separately from bankers, completely separately from factory workers, that might get you some distance. But in the end, what you really need to understand is the interaction between all of these things. And so there's always been this temptation in neuroscience for hundreds of years, actually, to say, this part of the brain does X. And it turns out it's never going to sort of tell us the big picture the way we need to do it, the way we need to understand it, because everything is interconnected in a massive network.
Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller, and we'll talk next with someone in Savoy. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. What is your opinion of Carl Jung's view of the unconscious?
So, thank you for that question. Carl Jung, like Sigmund Freud before him, was very interested in the subconscious. Oh, and by the way, for the listeners, I use the term subconscious and unconscious synonymously. The psychoanalysts used the term subconscious. Neuroscientists tend to use the term unconscious. Maybe it's to provide some distance there with the psychoanalysts, but anyway, it's the same thing. Freud and Jung were very fascinated by this, and they did a lot of work to really bring to attention how much is down there. Now, Jung had this very beautiful idea that maybe somehow down in these subterranean caverns of the unconscious, we're all tapped into something in common. It's a lovely idea. There's no scientific evidence that supports it. I mean, there's none that refutes it either, but there's no way to gather data on that at the moment. So there's nothing much to say about that except that it's a nice idea. I don't think it's a necessary idea, because part of his reason for suggesting a collective unconscious was this idea that if you look across cultures and across times, you find people coming up with the same sorts of structures and ideas. But you don't actually need to appeal to a collective unconscious there. All you need to do is recognize that brains have the same structures in them across cultures. And even though human evolution has done a lot in terms of changing skin color and height and eye color and little peripheral things like that, fundamentally, brains are exactly the same anywhere you look in human culture. And so the same sorts of things fall out of it. And that's, I think, maybe a sufficient explanation why you find commonalities across cultures, and we don't necessarily have to appeal to us being tapped into something collective.
Thank you.
In this hour focus, our guest is David Eagleman. He holds joint appointments in the departments of neuroscience and psychiatry at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And he is also founder and director of the Initiative on Neuroscience and the Law, and is author of a book that we're talking about here. That the title of the book is Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. Well, I want to just for a second try and get back to something that one of the earlier callers asked, because I think it's really an interesting area. People, I think, are used to this idea that the brain has these two halves and that different parts of the brain do different things. And when you talk about consciousness, there have been people who have said, well, consciousness really has to do with getting the two parts to work together, and that going way far back, they were much more divided. And when they kind of came together, that's where consciousness came to be. I don't know where that kind of idea stands right now, but can you talk about the idea of the brain as this two-chambered thing?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is I'm not really swayed by that idea. So a guy named Julian Jaynes wrote that in the 1970s, and it was a very wacky speculative hypothesis. And as Richard Dawkins said, nobody knows if it's, you know, if it's genius or rubbish, but there's certainly no good evidence supporting that view. I think we have maybe a more sophisticated view of this now. And that is what I argue in the book in Incognito is that the right way to think about the brain is like a team of rivals. You actually have lots of subparts in the brain that are always battling it out to control your behavior. And so, for example, at the highest levels, you have things like short versus long-term decision making. So if I put a tempting chocolate chip cookie in front of you, part of your brain wants to eat that because of the delicious sugar and energy source, and part of your brain doesn't want to eat it because you want to stay physically fit and look good, and you can have this arm wrestling that happens between these parts of your brain. And this is why humans can cuss at themselves and get angry at themselves and cajole themselves and contract themselves. And, the question is, who is talking with whom here? The answer is, you're not one thing under the hood. You've got lots of different pieces and parts that are always trying to control your behavior. And this is the sense in which humans can be conflicted, but you can't imagine a toaster or an automobile being conflicted. An automobile just has one steering wheel, and whichever way it goes, that's the way the car goes. So it turns out when you really start reaching your arms down into this, it's not just short and long-term decision-making that battle it out. It's all sorts of different things in your brain that are battling it out. And sometimes we can lump different parts together and talk about them crudely, like emotion versus reason, which are just labels that we use to conveniently summarize some issues. But as you go down to smaller and smaller levels, you find these battles happening at every level. And so what I synthesize in the book is this idea that really the way to think about the brain is like a neural parliament, and you've got these different political parties, all of which love their country, but have a totally different idea about how to go about it. Just like we have Republicans and Democrats and Tea Party and Independents and so on, they all think they know what the right thing to do is. It's just those can be quite different, and they have to battle it out.
Well, I guess I also think, though, isn't it the case, and maybe I'm not understanding or vastly oversimplifying, but some people have made this argument that, well, if we could take enough computers and hook them all together so that they could all interact, that somehow consciousness or some kind of consciousness would arise out of that. But I'm not sure that it actually would. Doesn't there have to be some sort of, doesn't there have to be a prime minister or some kind of organizing central authority?
Well, there are two different issues there. So it would be the analogy of taking a bunch of computers and hooking them up and getting consciousness would be like me saying, if I take enough hunks of metal and I put them together, then I should get an airplane that flies out of it. The answer is that'll never happen because it needs to be exactly right. It needs to be, the brain is running programs that we haven't even scratched the surface of yet. So we can't just take computers and smush them together and hope to get something interesting out of it. And as far as a central prime minister, it turns out that's the interesting part. There isn't that in the brain. It's exactly like a parliament that has to debate and fight it out and compromise. And you get, one party winning this time and another party winning the next time. But it's an organic thing that comes out of the debate of the parties. It's not some central authority that's determining it.
Okay, let's talk with someone in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, I'm listening with great interest. I was wondering, I have several questions. I was wondering if you would speak about the amygdala and mental health. And I was wondering if you have any experience of Kundalini energy as with relation to the brain. Also, if you feel that science and metaphysics will at some point in the future fuse and we'll have a better understanding of more spiritual, unexplainable phenomena.
Okay, well, thank you for those three questions. Let me just briefly say the amygdala is it's a part of the brain that's essentially your emergency control center, and when things really start hitting the fan, this area comes online, and it's able to control very well the whole rest of what's going on in your brain, and it gets everybody to focus on, what's the situation at hand. And so the amygdala is really useful to have in, your immediate stress response. One of the problems that we all suffer with in modern life is that we have chronic stress and we have things all the time that are blinging and banging and we have bosses that are hanging over us and we have subway cars that we're packed into. And so our brains and bodies weren't really built that much for this kind of chronic stress. And so we get a lot more amygdala activation than we should. And I'll just mention that when people are in a really scary situation, the amygdala is involved in laying down memories on a secondary memory track. So the memories of post-traumatic stress disorder, these flashbulb memories, come from what's happening in the amygdala. So I'll just say that by way of some quick summary. As far as Kundalini energy, I don't unfortunately know anything about that, really. It's not part of sort of central modern neuroscience. Maybe it could be at some point, but at the moment it's not. And as far as science and metaphysics, whether I think they'll fuse, I kind of feel like it's the case that, science has the widest possible net. And so anything that one might call an unexplainable phenomenon makes the shift into science as it becomes explainable. I mean, it goes from metaphysics to becoming a part of mainstream science. I mean, just look at your garage door opener. It's like magic, right? You hit a button and something happens at a distance and it seems invisible. It's like some little thing goes out from your garage door opener and causes an effect at a distance, invisibly. It's like magic, and if you came from 500 years ago and showed up in present time, you would, call it metaphysical. You'd call it something special, but it becomes science. So thanks for those questions.
I have a question here that came in by email. Someone wants to know what your opinion of fMRI is, and the person writes, even though this technology has been around for a long time, it seems that in the past several years, neuroscientists have been using this for all manner of experiments, like lie detection, for example. Considering the complexity of the brain, do you think that scientists are inferring too much from these scans?
Interesting. Okay, so for the listeners, fMRI stands for functional magnetic resonance imaging. That's the most popular technique for doing brain scans, for taking pictures of what's going on in the brain. It's a non-invasive technique that allows us to look at what's happening inside the skull and see the brain and see where the activity is happening in the brain. It has become very popular in the last decade, and the asker of the question is correct to have some healthy skepticism there, because even though it is our best technique currently, it still is crude, and we can only see sort of large chunks of activity as opposed to what's happening at the level of individual cells in the brain, or even hundreds or thousands of cells. Instead, we're looking at millions of cells at a time. You know, I would say in general, this is the way science always goes. We make better and better technologies, and we use those technologies to get deeper and deeper into the questions, and we always maintain care and healthy skepticism in trying not to infer too much. It is the case that the public often infers a lot from seeing these pictures of the brain, because visuals are very compelling. But the scientific community tries anyway to do responsible interpretation of the data.
We are moving into about our last 10 minutes in the program here. David Eagleman is our guest. He's a neuroscientist at the Baylor College of Medicine and is author of the new book, Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. Pantheon is the publisher. Well, you know, I'm sure that there are some people who might, thinking about the implications of what we're talking about, might find this a little disturbing, in the sense that we like to think we're in control. We like to think that when we make decisions, large or small, we are making those decisions. We are weighing the pros and cons of doing one thing or doing another thing. But ultimately, we are making that decision without any real, without constraints. The free will, I guess, is what I'm talking about. It would make it sound like what you would be saying is that because there's all this stuff going on in the brain, all this processing information, we're having this big parliamentary debate that we're also not completely aware of, then that takes this notion of that we're actually making choices and that we have some freedom to make choices. That kind of tosses the whole thing out the window.
Sort of. So this question of free will has been, of course, debated for millennia now, and I don't think that we have a killer experiment that rules in or out free will. Most neuroscientists feel that we probably don't have free will, and the reason is, when you look at what's happening in the brain, everything is connected to and driving other things. And so it's all connected in a big massive network, and that means it's difficult to figure out where to squeeze in the ghost in the machine, because everything is sort of mechanically connected, even though it's very vast and complex. Okay, I'm not certain that we don't have free will. It may be that we do have something like free will, but that our science is too young to understand what that means. But what is clear to me, and what I argue in the book, is that if we have free will, it's actually a bit player in what's happening in the brain. Because of our individual trajectories of development, people's brains are quite different. And you can't take two very different brains and say, oh, well, just use your free will to act like this other brain, because you just can't do it. In other words, we might have a little bit of play in the wheel that's something like free will, but you can't change yourself entirely. I mean, just take, you know, whatever your sexual orientation is, try swapping that and being the other kind. Well, you just can't do it, right? You can't use your free will to do that. You can't take a serial murderer like Ted Bundy and say, hey, Ted, just use your free will to not do that anymore. Or I can't say to you, hey, just use your free will to be like Ted Bundy and go kill people. You just have different brains. And even though you have a little bit of play in the wheel, you can't change yourself very much. And so I think what this does is it certainly refines our notions or our hopes about free will. And just to return to this company analogy, you know, if you ask, okay, well, does the CEO have free will to, you know, steer the company in any direction? The answer is no, because the CEO is tied into the 100,000 employees, into what they want to do, into the unions, into the momentum of the company. He or she can make little changes, but it's this huge nested feedback loop between the CEO and the rest of the company, and the whole organism of the company is essentially making decisions and choosing, but it's not clear that there's sort of a single central driver that's just, you know, can make any kind of decisions they want.
Hmm. You know, we were talking earlier about criminal behavior and about how, you know, maybe it is difficult to understand why it is, or at least to get to the bottom of why it is, say, for example, that, you know, some people would show extremely antisocial behavior and would look at other people as being perfectly appropriate to take advantage of them and use them for your ends. So you have people like that, but then you also have people who go by the golden rule and try to treat other people the way they would like to be treated. And maybe it's just as difficult to explain why that kind of person is that way. Having said all that, I think there are people, though, who make this argument that says, really, one is more predominant and natural to us. One is more fundamental to our nature than the other. And I wonder what you think about that. Basically, this is the argument that says, well, basically, the question is, are people basically bad or good? This argument says, well, basically, people are good. And if that is so, then also you'd have to say, well, that probably means that they're wired to be good. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, what's clear is that through evolutionary pressures, we have developed a lot of pro-social behaviors. So brains are very social organs, and they care a lot about interacting with other people, and they care about things like trust and reputation and so on. And as a result, what's happened is, on average, the species is pretty good at getting along. Mm-hmm. That said, there's lots of variability in the species at any given time. And so at any given time, you'll have a certain percentage of species that are cheaters, that are freeloaders, that are aggressive and willing to steal, and so on. And this is the unfortunate truth of the way it'll always be. And this is, of course, why we have a penal system, because if we want society to run smoothly in this pro-social manner, then we have to take bad actors off of the street. But there's no point in saying, well, humans are basically anything, because in fact, along any axis that you measure people, you find it's a distribution, right? And this is why when you watch politics and they say, well, I think what the American people want is blah, it doesn't even make any sense. There is no American person. I mean, there's a huge distribution of types in the country. And so I think that's really the nuanced way that we need to understand the species, is that brains are like snowflakes. Because of the individual history of the wind and the temperature and the altitude and so on, each snowflake comes out differently, and that's how human brains come out as well.
Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I've caught most, if not all, your show, and I hope I'm not touching a covered subject, but I've heard it said more than once that your stomach is a second brain. As any dieter will tell you, they can't control not eating. And in the case of sometimes when people have heart bypass, even though it doesn't affect their stomach in any way, they lose control of their bowels and their stomach and things. And it makes me wonder, is there a relationship between your stomach and brain, more than just, you know, your brain trying to control your stomach, but your stomach also controlling your brain?
Thank you for that question. It's a little bit, it's too metaphorical to suggest that the stomach is a second brain, but it is the case that your entire body influences your cognition and your perception. So the brain is fundamentally the densest representation of you and your hopes and your dreams and your aspirations and your behaviors. But the whole rest of the body is involved also. So, for example, your immune system, your endocrine system, your digestive system, all of these can be thought of as parts of the greater nervous system. They do influence your behavior and your feelings and your thoughts. And it may be that the feelings that we have with emotions, when you're happy, when you're sad, when you're angry, when you're in love, these involve feelings from your whole body. It involves what's happening in your stomach and in your muscles and so on. So this is what people refer to as embodied cognition. In other words, you can't think about cognition as just a brain in a jar. You have to think about it as a brain that's embodied in this, you know, in this flesh machine that we're in. So thank you for that question. It is the case that all this other stuff is part of us.
We're just, we have about a minute or so. You know, it seems that maybe in the last couple of years there's been a flurry of books published that one way or another are about how it is that what's out in the world, how our perceptions of what's in the world get formed and how they get in our head and how it is we form this picture of the world. And I think the bottom line here is that despite the fact that we think we see what's there, that's not the case at all. We take in all kinds of information. It gets processed and a certain picture of the world gets formed, which may or may not correspond to the real world. Knowing that, though, is it actually possible for people to do anything about that, or is that wiring so fundamental that even if you explain it to someone, they can't think differently?
It's the latter. We have no cognitive penetrance into our sort of this illusion of reality. So when you open your eyes, you say, okay, well, there's the world out there and all of its colors and shapes and so on. I obviously won't have time to cover this in the remaining minute, but that's all a construction of the brain. Colors don't even exist in the outside world. All you have is electromagnetic radiation of different wavelengths, and your brain interprets that as colors. And your brain and my brain might interpret those quite differently on the inside in terms of how we paint it on the inside. No matter what I tell you, though, you're still going to see blue as blue. And I think this is one of the interesting things in neuroscience, which is, you know, even if I were to explain to you every last detail down to the molecules of why you have a pleasurable experience when you eat strawberry ice cream, that won't diminish your enjoyment at all. You'll still enjoy it just as much. You'll still see the blue. You'll still enjoy the strawberry ice cream and so on. So it turns out that it's a very deeply wired construction about reality. And, I mean, in some ways it's very fragile because with brain damage, your whole view of the world can change. You can lose the ability to see colors, for example. But in general, yep, we can't talk ourselves out of seeing reality the way we do.
All right. A lot of interesting stuff in the book. It's Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, published by Pantheon, by our guest David Eagleman. He holds joint appointments in the departments of neuroscience and psychiatry at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. Professor Eagleman, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Hey, how'd you like to help this radio station and spiff up your driveway at the same time?
What are we doing, going into the paving business once again?
No, it's Car Talk's new vehicle donation program where you donate a car. The proceeds benefit this station and you tuck it to the IRS at the same time.
Hat trick!
And you can do it all on the web.
To learn more, call 866-789-8627.
Millions of people spent 2011 pondering this weighty question.
Will only a few select people make it to heaven? And will billions and billions of people burn forever in hell?
Does hell exist, and is heaven only for good Christians? That quandary helped make 2011 a good year for hell. Hear about it today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
And at 10:58, I'm Jeff Bossert with a look at the markets. At this hour from Kansas City, winter wheat is at 703 quarters. Just an update here, checking the markets, 703 quarters. That's up 5 from Chicago. March wheat, 652. That's up 7 1/4. May, 669 1/4, up 7 1/4. March corn from Chicago, 638 1/2, up 5 1/2. May, 646 1/2, up 5 1/4. July corn, 652 1/2, up 5. February crude oil, 99.67, down 167. January beans, 11.96 and a half, down 3 1/4. March, 12.06, down 3 1/2. May beans, 12.15 and a quarter, down 4. July, 12.24 and a half, down 4. August, 12.16 and a quarter, down 8 1/4. January bean meal, 307.80, up 10. January bean oil, 51.71, that's down 13. December live cattle, 122.90, down 35. February, 122.95, down 25. January feeder cattle, 147.60, up 45. March, 150.55, that's up 27 1/2. February lean hogs, 86.35, that's up 60. April, 89.20, up 45. Looking at the outside markets right now, we've got RBOB gasoline at 265.60,